Well, good afternoon. We're just about set for our third case in Monroe County today. This morning, we had a number of students that were with us. This afternoon, they had to go back to school. So we don't have a number of students, but it's absolutely our pleasure. And thank you all for coming to see the Wisconsin Supreme Court hear oral argument and to hear what I think will be some excellent oral arguments. Are you prepared to proceed?
We are.
All right. And you also?
Yes.
All right. Then I'll call our third case, Klinger versus Crown Equipment.
Kleininger?
I said it wrong. You know, with a name like Rogensack, you would really think I could say anything, but it turns out I can't. So, okay. Please begin. Yeah, that's fine if you like. We know who you are. We've got your name, rank, and serial number, but you need to be before the mic, and that's fine.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Ordinary commuting time is never compensable. That's true under federal law. That's true in the other 49 states, and that has always been true in Wisconsin as well. Now, in this case, there were 86 employees who were given an option. They could drive their own personal vehicle to the branch to commute at the beginning of the day and then drive their own personal vehicle back home at the end of the day. Or they could take a company vehicle home at night and commute in that company vehicle, which 86 out of 86 of the employees who are putative class members in this case decided to do. It was a win-win proposition.
And the win for Crown Equipment is that they have to pay less to the employees in travel time, right?
I think that can be true in some cases, although the employees get to choreograph their own day from job site to job site. And so the employees get more time, typically, that is work time, and so that's a win for them. And it just makes sense for the company as well that a person can go directly from their home to their first job site. So the starting point for this analysis is the Portal to Portal Act of 1947, which was passed by the U.S. Congress. And that was a rule that says commuting time is never compensable. The Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, enacted regulations which further explained the rules as they would apply to commuting time. And included in those rules are two primary characteristics. The first is that commuting is a voluntary activity. It is done because it's voluntary on the part of the employee. It's also done within a regular, ordinary commuting area for the employee. In 1978, Wisconsin enacted its own regulations, and Wisconsin had a choice to make. It could make a variety of different rules for commuting, but Wisconsin decided to adopt the federal standard word for word. It was duplicated, lifted right off of the federal standard, with the exception of some pronouns, no substantive changes. And so the Wisconsin regulations include the very same two components which define commuting.
So let me fast forward a little bit on the federal legislative front. So eventually, the federal legislature adopted the Employee Commuting Flexibility Act, right? And part of the question, I think, part of the argument that you're making today is that we should interpret our statute and regulations in light of the ECFA. Is that right?
The ECFA, the Employee Commuting Flexibility Act, is an interpretive tool that has two components in it.
Why should that be an interpretive tool to our statutes and our regulations?
Because ECFA is an interpretive tool that has two components. The first is that there's an agreement between the employee and the employer.
Right, but aside from what ECFA provides for, why should we care what ECFA says?
because the two components in ECFA are already embedded in and woven through the Wisconsin regulatory scheme that we have.
Okay, then can't we just concentrate on Wisconsin statute and Wisconsin regulations?
From Crown's standpoint, Crown would win this case either way, with or without ECFA, because the two elements that are in ECFA are already in the Wisconsin statute.
Right. So, but at some point we're going to have to write an opinion and describe why we come to the conclusion that we do. I'm concerned with this idea that a federal statute adopted after our statute was enacted would have anything to say about what our law is.
When Congress passed ECFA, Congress was very clear that it was merely clarifying and teaching what the law always has been. It said that. It made the rule retroactive so that it applied even to disputes that preceded its passage.
Right. So let's
and the courts have said that ECFA is a clarifying law. The Seventh Circuit has said that, the Fifth Circuit has said that, and the Tenth Circuit
right.
has said that.
So let's say that's true. Still not sure why I should care. We adopted our own statute and our own regulations. And it may have been word for word for what the federal legislature did. But these are our words. And they're not dependent on what the federal legislature says about anything, right?
Well, commuting under Wisconsin law has never been compensable.
Right. So let's kind of, so, and so that goes back to my original question, which is, can't we resolve this simply on state law grounds, without reference to federal law at all?
Yes, I think that the company wins this dispute either way, with or without ECFA. But I think ECFA is a very helpful interpretive tool that is entirely consistent with Wisconsin law. That would certainly put Wisconsin in step with the rest of the company or the country. And this is certainly a sector of the economy. We know that there are in the construction industry and in the service industry, this is happening all over the state of Wisconsin. And the rule has always been assumed to be that commuting is non-compensable. So when Congress came along and said, yes, this is what the federal rule, which is the very same thing as Wisconsin's rule. So when the Congress and when the courts, the federal courts have said this framework after which Wisconsin's rules were patterned word for word, why would Wisconsin deprive itself of this interpretive tool that's being used around the rest of the country when it's entirely consistent with the Wisconsin scheme, when it has the elements of voluntariness and ordinariness, geographical ordinariness and personal voluntariness? That's the definition of commuting under Wisconsin rule anyway. Why would Wisconsin deprive itself of this interpretive tool in a way that deviates from the rest of the country?
Well, why do we need it, though? I think what Justice Kelly has been trying to ask or has been asking you is, why don't we just apply DWB 272.12 sub 2 sub G travel time? The whole case has been focused on it and postured in the context of ECFA, and I don't really understand it because, as you have pointed out in your argument, Wisconsin law addresses the very issue. So why are the parties talking about ECFA at all?
Because Wisconsin, in every case that we see, whether it's your Hormel decision that the Supreme Court recently decided or other decisions, Wisconsin looks to federal law where it makes sense as an interpretive guide for what the law should be and what the court should do.
But that's... Look, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have, as a follow-up to Justice Bradley's questions, and of course any time a Justice Bradley asks a question, it's got to be a good one. So as a follow-up, thank you. As a follow-up to that question, first of all, we didn't, after the 1996 change in ECFA, adopt the language regarding incidental activities, did we? I don't think we adopted that.
You mean with respect to ECFA?
Yes.
No, Wisconsin did not enact its own ECFA.
Well, no, I mean this, that in 1996, ECFA added the following language. The use of an employer's vehicle for travel by an employee and activities performed by an employee which are incidental to the use of such vehicle for commuting shall not be considered part of the vehicle for travel is within the normal commuting area. But Wisconsin law does not have that same incidental to the use of language that I could see. I don't think we adopted it right. You keep on saying we have the same language. I don't think we adopted the same language. And so clarify that.
It is not the same language, but it's certainly the same concepts. If we look at DWD point 12.
But we stopped it. So it's not the same language.
It is certainly not the same language, okay. And Wisconsin has not adopted ECFA.
The Court of Appeals, as I recall in preparation for this case, sent back the issue of the state law question, in other words, whether you'd be covered by state law. We took this case with two issues, and both were ECFA. And the first, I'm going to paraphrase, it was like, must ECFA apply? And the second that you framed for us was, are we allowed to consider it? That's what we have, and the Court of Appeals said there wasn't enough to be able to decide, and you need an evidentiary issue of the circuit court to decide an issue, a remaining issue, and that is, how does it play out, how do the facts here play out vis-a-vis the state law? Do you think that they were correct that there had to be a remand?
No, not at all. I think the Court of Appeals went out of its way to say that Wisconsin courts were not permitted to even consider ECFA.
They remanded it for the state law. Do we have enough? They said there was inadequate briefing and inadequate record to decide this on summary judgment. The circuit courts decided it on summary judgment, and they said, no, you've got to develop it. It isn't an ECFA. If you want to proceed on state law, you got to have an evidentiary hearing. You don't agree with that.
We do not. We see this the same way that the DWD saw it when DWD provided that these two same components, the personal voluntariness and geographical ordinariness, the DWD said, yeah, that's the rule that should apply. Even though it's consistent, in spite of the fact that it's consistent with federal law.
So what you're saying is that the facts that are in the record are enough for us to decide as a matter of law whether Crown has to pay for this back and forth commuting time.
They absolutely are in the record. There are no disputes of fact with respect to this case. Employees had a choice of whether to commute in a van and drive or commute in their car. And drive.
And that doesn't matter whether we apply the principles of ECFA or the actual state law.
That's exactly correct.
What about DWD 272.12 sub 2 sub G 5? Isn't there not enough in the record for the court to consider that provision, which talks about picking up and carrying the tools? I just don't know that this record was developed as to what that looked like. Whether that was a necessary component to the travel, how big are these tools? Some of those issues were not fleshed out.
Thank you for that, and I'm glad that you raised this. Wisconsin regs 272.12.2G provide for five different kinds of driving. Five. The first one is home to work ordinary situation, and that's what this case is about. And so the company would certainly object to any suggestion that the square peg of this commuting time should be forced into the round hole of one of these other regulations. Look at what these other regulations are. Number three is home to work in emergency situations. That doesn't apply. The next kind of driving is home to work on special one-day assignment in another city. That doesn't apply. The next one is travel that is all in the day's work. And Justice Dallet, that's the one you just pointed to. Crown agrees and has always paid for travel time that is all within a day's work. Once the field service technician arrives at his, and they happen to all be men, his first job of the day, that and then drives to subsequent spots throughout the rest of the day, every one of those driving miles throughout the course of the work day is paid. And that's not what this case is about. What this case is about is solely this first regulation, which is home to work, ordinary situation. That first drive from work, from home in the morning to your first job site, and from your last job site back home at the end of the day. That is the definition of an ordinary commute. And none of these other regulations, whether it's 3, 4, 5, or 6, should be applied to a case of ordinary commuting.
So you're saying the tools and the impact of having to have those vans does not apply because it is home to work, and that's what it's falling under. We don't need to develop the record further about whether those tools and that van is a necessary piece. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right. Why would it make sense for this court to apply a regulation that is on its face for a different kind of driving? The only regulation that applies in this case is Section 2G2, which is home to work, ordinary situation, an employee who travels from home before the regular workday and returns to their home at the end of the workday, is engaged in ordinary home to work travel, which is a normal incident, and there's our word incident, of employment. This is true whether they work at a fixed location or different job sites. Normal travel time from home to work is not work time.
Let me ask, because the Court of Appeals in paragraph 24 says this in conclusion, that, okay, now we've decided that ECFA standard does not apply in a Wisconsin wage law claim. But then it goes on to say, the next question is this, and neither the Circuit Court nor Crown has addressed the topic of whether absent ECFA, what the Wisconsin law is. Neither the Circuit Court nor Crown has addressed this topic, and we conclude we lack sufficient adversarial briefing to address it. And then they say, based on the briefing before us, we're uncertain whether there might be one or more genuine issues of material fact. Accordingly, we reverse the summary judgment. Was the Circuit Court correct in saying that the issue was never addressed by, excuse me, was the Court of Appeals correct in saying that the Circuit Court never addressed the issue of whether the Wisconsin, who would prevail under Wisconsin law if ECFA had nothing to do with it? Did the Circuit Court address that issue?
I think the Circuit Court made a distinction between the federal law and the state law and pointed out that these are consistent. There's no reason to read them inconsistently. I don't know that the legal arguments were developed quite as pristinely as to make the, you know, a lot of daylight between the two.
Well, the Court of Appeals says you didn't really address that topic in the Circuit Court, nor the Circuit Court or Crown has addressed this topic. What I'm trying to do is find out what we have before us. I know what the two issues are as you frame them in your petition for review, and they both deal with ECFA. And if ECFA doesn't apply, then the question is, how do you interpret and apply Wisconsin law? And based on that interpretation, are there any genuine issues of material fact? Have those been explored by the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals?
I think what the Circuit Court concluded, which is the same thing that the DWD concluded at the administrative level, was that ECFA is an interpretive tool, and that it makes sense to interpret state law in a way that is consistent with it, because the two elements of ECFA, an agreement, which is present in this case, and ordinary commuting area, which is present in this case, those two components of ECFA are already in the state law. We've always talked about this as an interpretive tool. And so I think the Circuit Court decision more than adequately addresses that question.
So what you're saying, and maybe kind of missed review on the Court of Appeals, if I understand Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's concern, is that
Both DWD and the circuit court did not apply ECFA. They simply used it as a help in interpreting Wisconsin law.
And I can't know exactly what's in their mind when they made the decision. ECFA was certainly in play, and I'm not being shy about that fact, but it was being applied solely as a tool and not as the binding
law
that applies and that controls, because of course federal law cannot control what this court decides to do. The implications in this case are, I think, fairly profound. If we start going down this road to ask what's incidental, and someone says, well, I'm driving a company vehicle and I'm putting a tool in the back, I'm putting a wrench in the trunk, or if we have a paralegal, most paralegals are hourly employees, and the paralegal puts a laptop in the bucket seat right next to him or her, that laptop might be the most necessary and indispensable tool that that paralegal uses the entire day, right? Does that suddenly, when you put a laptop in the seat next to you, does that convert your commute to work? Because you're bringing tools along, right? It seems preposterous to think that that could be the case, but I think this is the road that we're on here as long as we start doing this metaphysical dance of how incidental is it and what quantum of benefit does the employer get versus the employee.
So what is 5 reserved for then? DWD 272.12 sub 2 sub G 5 that talks about the tools, picking up and carrying the tool. What is it? What kind? You're saying it's not every tool. It's not every. What would you see that exception?
5 is restricted to travel that is all in a day's work. That's once you get into your first job of the day. You show up at the guard shack, you punch into your computer that you're here, your time starts, you're on the clock, and every bit of driving that you do for the rest of your workday is travel that is all in a day's work. And that's the name of number 5.
Wouldn't that be no matter whether you had tools or not? If you're traveling for your work, wouldn't that be covered? Why is that in there? I mean, you probably don't know the answer, but I guess what's the interpretation that Crown is giving that provision as to why that's there with respect to having that extra piece? Because here we've got vans, right, that I assume have some, I don't know if they're loaded with tools. I mean, I just don't know.
They have tools and equipment in them, to
be
sure.
Things that couldn't be necessarily put in someone's car.
That's true, but they're still, they're necessary and indispensable to the work in the same way that a paralegal's laptop would be. Paragraph 5, G5, applies solely to travel that's all in a day's work. So that's within the confines of the workday. And this case is about the commuting time that bookends that workday.
So it's outside of when you punch out. You punch out, and then you commute home. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay, and 5, you have to be punched in for it to click in, and then it doesn't matter if you're drawing from job site to job site and picking up tools or not, then you're in 5.
That is exactly correct. And I think I have maybe used up some of my time, so I'll reserve the rest for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Oh, just a minute. I think you have, does he have 10 minutes left on this?
You
have 3 minutes left now, and then you still have some reserve time. So she'll give you a red card when this section is done, according to your request.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Dalit's question about sub 5 again. If I'm understanding her question, I think it goes to the second sentence of sub 5, where an employee is required to report to a meeting place. Now, to receive instructions or to perform other work there are not in play. But to get to the point of the tools, it says where an employee is required to report at a meeting place to pick up and to carry tools. The travel from the designated place to the workplace is part of the day's work. So I read that to mean it's a place other than the home front, because in this case, the employees are not going home to pick up tools. The tools are in the car. So I think it applies to a different situation than we have here, but I'd like you to address that.
Right. So if any of the 86 employees in this particular case had decided to drive in their own personal vehicle, they would drive first to a branch. They would commute from their house to the branch, whereupon they would pick up a company truck. And from that moment, they're working. That's no longer commuting. They've just picked up the company truck and they're driving to their first job site. That drive is compensable because that's not commuting. That's not from their house. And at the end of the day, they come back to the branch, they drop off their van, and then they commute, ordinary commute, home. And so the regulation that applies home to work ordinary situation applies when you're going back home, to and from your house. And number five is the regulation that applies once you've already started working. Either you've arrived at the branch or you've arrived at your work site. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, the plaintiffs in this case have failed to point to any good law that supports the proposition that this time, with tools or without tools, is going to be compensable. There is the Baker case that was overturned by the Seventh Circuit. That was a case where the time prior to ECFA would have been compensable. It was overturned and reversed by the Seventh Circuit on the basis of ECFA, but it's very clear from Judge Easterbrook's opinion that there's no way this case was going to be sustained on appeal regardless. Judge Easterbrook wrote, 13 employees who signed up for this win-win proposition acknowledged in writing that they would not be paid, but later filed suit. He later went on and said, these employees went back on their word because they said, we want to drive this van. This is good for us, and we agree we will not be paid. And it rankled Judge Easterbrook, I think, and the Seventh Circuit opinion or panel that signed on to this, that these employees now were deciding 2 years after the fact, oh, you know that form that I signed that says I'm just going to commute and I'm not going to work, I'm not going to gas up, I'm not going to service my van, I want to sign my name here and sign me up for this good benefit. It rankled the Seventh Circuit that these employees were going back on their word and deciding to now get paid and sue for wages when they had known at the outset that that would not be compensable time. I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thanks.
You are quite a bit taller. I know we're going to hear you because the mics in here are pretty good, but you might raise the mic just a little bit, yeah, so that the folks in the back hear you.
Thank you. Let me begin by explaining the procedural posture of this case in response to various questions that were raised, and then I'll talk about G5, which also has been asked a lot about, and then I will get into how that relates to what we think the real issues are, which haven't yet been addressed. So the procedural posture of this case is that the parties filed, cross-filed for summary judgment. Neither side alleged there were any facts in dispute. The plaintiffs argued two things. One is that under the Wisconsin regulations, they prevail. The second thing they argued was that ECFA does not apply. The employer argued one thing. The employer argued ECFA bars this case. The employer never addressed plaintiff's argument that absent ECFA, the current Wisconsin state law compels a decision in plaintiff's favor. They never addressed that in the circuit court, in the court of appeals, and for the first time in footnote 3 of their brief to this court, they address it and say, well, that's a dubious proposition.
Counsel, circuit court did address G2 and 5, didn't it? On page 11 of its opinion, as plaintiff's commuting time would not be compensable under ECFA, accordingly, it is not compensable under blah, 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 G2 and G5.
Well, it did address it. Well, it said it's not a payable under ECFA. So it really didn't use ECFA as this interpretive tool. It really applied it as if it were binding law, as if it superseded G2 and G5.
Well, it didn't, but if that were the case, then it would have had no need to cite state law, right? If the circuit court was deciding that federal law controls the question, all they would have had to say is plaintiff's commuting time is not compensable under ECFA, full stop. But it didn't say that, right? Okay, it went on to say, accordingly, it is not compensable under G2, G5 either.
But it's, in saying that, it's kind of it's giving the federal law superiority over the state law. It's saying that because ECFA prevails here, it doesn't matter what the state law says. It, so, kind of, it trumps the state law.
So is it your opinion that if G2 and G5 had said explicitly that time spent commuting in a company-owned vehicle is compensable, that the circuit court would have said, no, it's not because ECFA says it's not. Is that your position?
I think that's what the circuit court concluded, yes.
You think that's what the circuit court
yes,
was?
Yes.
So what about the language in the opinion that says it isn't compensable under DWD 272.12.2G?
Well,
why do you need to say that?
Okay, well, well,
ECFA is the only thing
okay.
you need to think about.
Well, that gets me into my second point, which is that this 2G was never cited by plaintiffs as a basis in the claim. This claim concerns not 2G, 272.12.2G.
Yeah.
This case concerns what is a principal activity.
But when does it matter that the plaintiff didn't cite 2G? It doesn't matter, does it? They won. So in the Court of Appeals, they can argue anything that supports the circuit court's decision.
Well, in the Court of Appeals, they did nothing more than to argue ECFA. And I don't believe that the circuit court opinion fairly read does anything other than apply ECFA. It says, under ECFA, plaintiffs lose.
Do you think there are any genuine issues of material fact that would preclude deciding this case as a matter of law under state law exclusively?
No, I do not. And plaintiffs set forth in detail why that was the case. The employer never responded to that argument, and that's why we say the employer has had two chances to do that. The employer has waived, it had three chances to do that. The employer has waived its right to contest absent ECFA, does state law require judgment in the plaintiff's favor. It never addressed that argument. It's waived that argument. So if this court finds ECFA doesn't apply, it must grant summary judgment in plaintiff's favor. There's nothing left to remand to the circuit court.
We can interpret the facts in light of the law, though. It's a question
certainly,
of law.
Certainly.
Agree.
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly. So let me, if I may, turn to G5.
Good. Thank you.
Travel, that is all in the day's work. Time spent by an employee in travel as part of their principal activity. It says such as, again, such as travel from job site to job site. Such as is intended to be an illustration, not an all-encompassing term. But what I focus on is part of their principal activity. Now, principal activity isn't defined in G5. You have to look at other provisions to decide what is principal activity. And there's two provisions which this court looked at in Hormel, which are germane here, and these provisions are the basis of the plaintiff's claim here. The first is under 272.12.1a, defining what is compensable work, and more importantly, under the E provision, which in detail defines what is a principal activity, integral and indispensable, and it has the three illustrations.
That was our doffing and donning.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so in order to resolve these claims, this court doesn't look at G5, doesn't look at G2. It looks at what is a principal activity as defined in E, as described by this court in Hormel. And so let me begin with Hormel. Hormel, you dealt with a very similar argument there, that this FLSA provision 2030, which exempted the activity if it involves changing clothes, that's addressed in the collective bargaining. That's an exemption. So the argument was, well, this court should apply 2030. In the same way, they're arguing this court should apply ECFA. This court very simply stated 2030 has no counterpart in state law. So we're not going to look at it.
How is the driving from home to work a preparatory or concluding activity under 2E of the same regulation?
Well,
that's how it defines principal activity,
yes, yes.
Which is what you want to talk about.
Yes. And it's covered, if you look at the language, of, under subsection E, it says activities that are an integral part of the activity and activities which are closely related activities that are indispensable to its performance. That's the standard this court applied in Hormel.
Sure.
And in Hormel, this court, you know, concluded that the protective, personal protective equipment was closely related to the performance of the work. So therefore, it was a principal activity. And again, principal activity, it was a principal activity under G5, it's compensable, as well as under E, for that matter.
Counsel, if this is going to work out to be something that falls within that definition, aren't you proving too much? Because that's going to work is always going to fall within that definition that you just proposed.
Well, the definition is it closely related to activities that are indispensable to its performance? That's a standard right from the statute.
Right.
And that this court applied.
So if going to, if that covers this situation, won't it always cover going from home to work?
No. And federal courts have grappled with this. Again,
I'm not interested in what the federal courts are saying.
No, but it doesn't apply to every situation. All we're saying is it applies to this particular situation where
hang on a second. We've got a limited amount of time here. I want to get zero in on my particular concerns. So what is it that distinguishes this from just driving to and from work?
Well, this is a situation where most employees don't park the company vehicle at their homes.
That's a benefit that is given by Crown, right?
Yes, but it's really not. It's a benefit that benefits Crown. The employee can't drop the child off at work. The employee can't stop at the grocery store to pick up a carton of milk on their way home. So there are restrictions. It's not a commute to work in the normal sense of the term.
But they chose it, right? This wasn't imposed by Crown. They voluntarily agreed. So using your examples, if they needed to or wanted to drop their child off at school or pick up a carton of milk on the way home, they would simply choose to drive their own vehicle so they could do those things. But here they chose to drive the employer's vehicle as a convenience for the employee, right?
Well, choosing is a term I hesitate to embrace because it's an established principle, and I cited in the brief two provisions in the statute which says that an employee cannot choose to waive his or her rights to receive the benefits of the wage and hour laws. You cannot waive your statutory rights voluntarily. There's two provisions saying that.
But can you define them? Can you define what you consider a commute? I'm looking at the contract.
Can the employer define what is a commute?
Well, I mean, there's an agreement, right? The employee signed it and said,
yes,
this is commute at the end and at the end of the workday. This is commute at the beginning of the workday. These are work-related activities. And it's directly labeled commute, travel time, guidelines, hourly technicians. And then it outlines what the expectation is, and then signed. So does that have no value to our analysis?
I don't think the parties can define a legal term. I mean, had the same agreement said the employee agrees to work for $5 per hour, that would not change the fact that under state law, the employee is entitled to the minimum wage. By the same token, regardless of what this agreement says between the employer and employee, a state law waged hour right cannot be waived by an employee.
But you're assuming that they have the right to be paid for this time, and opposing counsel's arguing that they don't.
That's correct. And the reason they have the right is, again, absent ECFA, what law do you apply? You apply the law that was in effect prior to ECFA in 1986. The very case which ECFA sought to overrule, the Baker, we submit, sets a proper standard of the term principal activity, integral, indispensable, to basically the identical back situation you have before you.
So this contract has no meaning in this determination?
I don't believe it does, because, again, the parties cannot redefine and result in an agreement that ends up in a waiver of an employee's statutory right. The same one applies as if the minimum wage.
Just specifically tell me which part of this agreement does waive their right to receive the compensation due.
Well, it defines what is compensable and what is not compensable. It says it's compensable only when you arrive at the work site, which means that their work to work site is not compensable. So that's what they're agreeing not to be paid for their travel from their home to their first work site.
Counsel, I want to take another run at this. Looking at the language in Hormel, among the activities included as an integral part of the principal activity are those closely related activities which are indispensable to its performance, right? And that's the standard you're arguing for.
Yes.
Okay. So person not driving a company car gets up in the morning to go to work. It is essential and indispensable that he drive there to work. Why would that not fall within that definition?
Well, that's not the definition of integral and indispensable as looked at by this court and applied by this court in Hormel in the first place. And so Hormel, under Hormel's standard, we submit, it's basically the same standard that the court applied in Baker, the same definition of principal activity.
You're getting away from me a little bit here. Okay. So let me just draw you a little back. So you're asking us to apply the Hormel formulation in this context.
Yes.
So what we're trying to do is figure out how broadly an effect this is going to have. So if we lift that out and we put this in the commuting context, I don't know how I would be able to say that driving to the office in the morning is not closely related and indispensable to the performance of your job. How would I say that's not indispensable, but driving the company truck is?
Well, if Hormel involved a situation where the employee put on the personal protective equipment at home and drove to work and said, I want to get paid for that, I don't think this court would have had any difficulty in saying, no, that's integral and indispensable because now, you don't need to put on his clothes to drive to work.
Concentrate for me, if you will, on commuting. Right? So we're writing up the opinion and we're trying to figure out, does every employee get paid for driving to work? Right? Because it's closely related and indispensable to their work to show up at work. Right? So on its face, the Hormel formulation applies to everybody who drives to the office to work. So how do we write an opinion that says that definition doesn't include that, but does include this?
Well, you look at the nature, the relationship between the commute and the work. It's obvious that driving to work, you couldn't work if you didn't drive to work. But in this situation, federal courts have looked at this in detail. There's not a single federal court that has said that integral and indispensable includes driving to work, even though, you know, certain employers, I'm sure, have argued that.
All right.
So again, that provides basis there to say that that's not the case.
So would you agree with me, then, that the Hormel formulation on its own is insufficient to answer the question before the court?
I don't. I believe it's sufficient insofar as it determines what is a principal activity and what is not. In Hormel, one of the arguments that was made was that, well, this, you know, these clothes, therefore the employee's own convenience. The employee wants to wear it to avoid getting dirty and so forth. So it's a benefit to the employee. The employee wants to do it. In the same respect, well, the employer here argues that, well, driving these cars from their own home, it helps the employees for their own convenience. This court in Hormel said, rejected that argument and said, well, if there's a little convenience for the employees, that's not the definition of a principal activity. It means the primary benefit of the work is to the employer. Here, there is no doubt that the primary benefit of this system helps the employer.
I think that's what Justice Goh is trying to get. Okay. So tell us how these facts, under what you're arguing, should apply. The specific facts that take this out of the regular commute.
Okay, well, again, the question under the Dunlap standard, which is basically, I think, the same as this court standard in Hormel, defining what a principal activity is does any of the activity inure to the benefit of the employer? Does any of it? If any of it does, it's considered a principal activity.
And what is it here that you think inures to the benefit that isn't just regular commute time that's saved?
Well, it inures to the benefit in the sense that, and I think we use Mr. Kenninger's situation as an example, where the bottom line is that the company doesn't have to pay him each day for 47 minutes that he would otherwise be paid in his commute from the Madison facility to the Beloit area where he works. That's 47 minutes. The company has this employee working productively at the site, earning money for the company.
But the company if they didn't want to pay this extra money, could say, okay, no more, folks. I hope all these other technicians like that, because if we agree with you, I would bet my socks that this benefit will be gone tomorrow, and everyone will drive their car to Madison, leave it, and pick up a van. That's what I bet.
I'm not sure. And what if it's required to be paid?
Well, if you are correct and the court affirms the decision below in a way that says you have to be paid for a commute if it's in a company vehicle. Okay, so right now there's a choice. You can take a company vehicle or not home. Okay, but if the company has to pay for a commute for the employees, why wouldn't the company say, okay, everybody just drive your car to Madison and we'll assign you where you're going to go for Madison. You are paid from that time. But then when the employee is done with the day, if he's working, in La Crosse, he's got to go all the way back to Madison, get his car, and then go home. Right?
Well, it's still
or if he's in Beloit and he lives in some area of Rock County, he's got to go all the way back to Dane County, Madison, get his car, and then he can go home. He'll get paid for that part if that's what he has to do.
Well, it still benefits the company to have Mr. Kenninger park his vehicle at his home. Even if it has to pay, it's got 4 to 7 more minutes a day where he is productive where he otherwise wouldn't be. So that's a pretty substantial benefit to the company. Even if it has to pay him, he's got that they have more time.
So any time there's a benefit to the company, then the employer has to pay.
Yeah, so that's the Dunlop standard, which this court followed.
Thank you. I understand better now. Thank you.
The company's benefited when the employee drives to work in the morning.
Again, I don't think that conclusion, if this court were to say, under these circumstances, that Mr. Kenninger must be paid, it doesn't follow that every employee who drives a company vehicle into work must be paid.
Because you say so. What we have to do is figure out a rule that doesn't require you to say whether it's appropriate or not to pay the employee under those circumstances. We got to figure out a rule that is essentially self-executing, right? So we got to say this kind of activity gets paid, everything else doesn't get paid. So the rule that you're proposing, any benefit to the company, that covers just general commutes, right? Because you got to go to the office in the morning to work, and commuting home. Well, a good employee is a rested employee. So that benefits the company, driving home. So why doesn't this cover every commute in the world? If the standard is that it's closely related and indispensable to performance of the job, and any benefit that inures to the company is compensable, every single commute is compensable.
I beg to differ, because what makes this integral, indispensable, closely related is that every employee who commutes to work doesn't have a truck full of tools and equipment that are built into their cars that are essential for that employee to perform the work. The work here is traveling to the employer's site and performing repair and maintenance work at that site. It is necessary to do two things. One, you have to drive there. Two, you need tools and equipment that the employer, that the customer doesn't have to perform that work. That is why both the driving and carrying the tools are integral and indispensable. If you look at G5, that's what G5 is hinting at. It's saying if you don't carry tools, that's part of your principal activity.
I don't think it quite says that, and I was asking your opposing counsel this question. The way I read that statutory section, it says where an employee is required to report at a meeting place to pick up and to carry tools, the travel to the workplace is part of the day's work. You kind of selectively edited out some of those.
Well, again, that whole phrase is an illustration. It's not intended to be exhaustive, I don't think.
It's not an illustration in the statutory text. It says where an employee is required to, bless you, to report at a meeting place. There's no meeting place involved in this case, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
But to apply that is, in essence, by parking the vehicle at the employee's home, that's not the actual work site. So by analogy, the home is, in essence, a meeting place. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch, but that's, again, this case is not about, we're not saying under G5, we're saying under 272.12.1 and E. That's the basis of our claim, not G2 and not G5.
You're not relying on 5 to support your claim.
Well, the 5 defines a principal activity. So, again, we're saying the claim is any principal activity the employee performs is compensable. And, again, Baker, yeah, that's what the standard is. The Baker case sets the standard. It applies case law. Had ECFLA not been passed, courts would be following Baker right now. And there might be a few disputes here and there, but under Baker, any arguments that driving to work in a normal instance is integral, indispensable, courts have uniformly rejected those arguments under the same analysis applied in Baker.
Okay, so let's look at G5, and I want to look at the last two sentences in conjunction, because I think this lays this out pretty clearly, I think. If an employee normally finished their work on the premises at 5, is sent to another job, which they finished at 8, and is required to return to the employer's premises arriving at 9, all of the time is working time, right?
Right.
Okay. However, if the employee goes home instead of returning to their employee's premises, so now the facts pattern is this. The employee finishes work on the premises at 5. He's sent to another job, which he finishes at 8. And then he goes home. Then we pick up in this sentence, the travel after 8 is home to work travel. It is not hours worked. How does this not read precisely on this case?
Because in the last two sentences, there is no assumption the employee is carrying tools. So or the employee is driving a company vehicle.
Okay, so why does that matter?
Well, because, again, the carrying of the tools, if you're carrying tools, and those tools are necessary to do your job, our position is that's a principal activity. That's what Baker held. That's what this court, that's the same principle as this court applied in Hermel held, is that
so
if it's a principal activity.
So instead of a company car, he throws a wrench in his trunk and goes home.
Again, federal courts have dealt with that and rejected it.
Okay.
Under the definition of principal activity.
I want to go back to the benefit to the employer, because what you said before was a little different than I had in mind when I came here. So I want to be sure that I really understand. What you're saying is when the employee drives his car, his van, from his home to work, the moment he clocks on, he begins to do repair work on all of these items for the employer. And so he should be paid, which he is. When the employee drives his own car to Madison, just say, picks up the van and then drives to Beloit, he's paid to drive to Beloit, but he's really not doing any work of fixing these machines for the employer, right?
That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that when the employee gets into his van at home, he's repairing. He's obviously not repairing. He's driving. And if I can address your point, is that why should the employee's right to receive pay depend on where he or she parks?
I was trying to figure out the benefit to the employer. So I was looking at a little different thing.
Okay.
And you tell me that Dunlap says any benefit to the employer, then you got to pay the employee. And your response, I thought, said that the employer was benefited by the employee choosing to drive the van from home to the work site, because he clocked in at the work site, and that moment on, he was doing repair work, which is what his job is. If, however, the employee had to go to Madison and pick up a van, leave his car there, he's not paid for that. He is paid from driving from Madison to, say, Beloit, okay? But the employer's not getting any repair work out of him for that period of time, okay?
Right.
So it is a benefit to the employer that as soon as he clocks in at the job site with the tools, or as compared with in Madison just to get in the car, the employer benefits from having him ready to repair vehicles by his driving the company van from home, because from the moment he clocks in, he can do repair work. From the moment he clocks in Madison to drive to Beloit, he can't do any repair work.
Yeah, well,
so that's the benefit you're talking about.
That's the benefit. The benefit specifically, again, in Kenninger's case, the employee gets an extra 47 minutes where he is at the job site every day doing work,
that's the same thing I'm trying to say.
Which generates revenues for the company.
Right.
That's a very significant productivity increase for the company. It would not otherwise have if he's just driving back and forth.
So you would say you looking at a case-by-case basis is how you would apply that to determine whether it was an ordinary commute and whether there was any benefit to the employer?
Yes.
Applying a rule in the future.
Yes, as courts did for many years prior to ECFA. Case-by-case, what's the principal activity? As this court did in Hormel, what is the principal activity? And these are standards that have been fleshed out for 50 years and are pretty well defined into all different scenarios, all different situations where employees try to abuse it by saying, well, I threw a wrench in my car, that's compensable. Of course, I've said, no, it's not. You have to show a tight nexus between the driving and what you're carrying in the vehicle and actually doing the job. It's a case-by-case analysis. There's no uniform rules. And so if this court disregards ECFA, which it should, this court is in essence applying the same definition of principal activity that federal courts have applied for 50 years and can certainly consult all federal case law in that, and that case law does not allow abuses and so forth. All those cases have been decided adversely to the employee. But it's not with ECFA.
Why would it not be abusive of this benefit for the employee to get the benefit of commuting in his employer's vehicle and then demanding that he gets paid for his commute at the same time?
Well, let me address that. Again, this is perhaps harking back to Justice Easterbrook's opinion. And with all due respect, I think what Justice Easterbrook overlooks when he's saying, well, the employees, they're double-dipping here. They sign this, and now they're backing out of this agreement. That's kind of a tainted situation. Like, what Justice Easterbrook overlooks is that, again, under federal law, the employee cannot, in the first place, sign an agreement which gives up his statutory rights to receive pay. You can't do that. There's a case that was decided, the Barrington case in 1981. Employees cannot waive their statutory rights. Two provisions in state law say the same thing. Employees cannot waive their statutory rights. So any agreement they sign doing that is null and void.
Okay, so if we agree with you on the interpretation of the statute, it doesn't matter what they signed because we would be interpreting their having a legal right to what they're waiving by their signature, correct?
Yes. And I don't know if you want to get into the fine points of is ECFA an exception or clarification or not, but I think I pretty well exculpated that in the brief. But fairly read, when you look at the legislative history, I don't think it can be said that this is intended as a clarification of the law. It's an exception to the law, and the reasoning in the Buzek case I think is pretty persuasive as a matter of textual analysis. It is an exception. And again, that buttresses the point that if it's an exception to the FLSA, then it's all the more inappropriate for this court to try to draft that on to state law. If you look at the 29 U.S.C. 254, it's sub 2, where ECFA appears in the federal statute, there is a sentence that precedes it. And it talks about what's for purposes of the subsector activities which are preliminary or post-preliminary to principal activities which occur either prior to the time on any particular workday at which the employee commences or subsequent to the time on any particular workday at which he ceases such principal activity. That's the first sentence. And then it says, for purposes of this subsection, then it sets forth the text of ECFA. That first sentence I read nowhere appears in Wisconsin state law. So to say that for purposes of this subsection, where would you put ECFA in Wisconsin state law when the very preceding sentence, that's the basis for ECFA, preliminary and post-preliminary activities, appears nowhere in the Wisconsin statutes? You'd be pulling something out of whole cloth to say Wisconsin law applied this when the very premise of ECFA in 254A, that sentence preceding it for purposes of the subsection, doesn't even appear in Wisconsin law. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you, mostly because I learned something in oral argument, which is always a good thing. I think I understood opposing counsel's argument better here than I had when I read the briefs. Do you agree that the employer gets more productive work time from the employee when he drives the van from home and clocks in at the job site than the employer gets when he picks up the van and drives to the job site during that comparable period of time?
I think that's true in some cases and not true in other cases, because remember that the job sites change.
I know.
And the schedules do. And so it may be that by virtue of having a van at home, the field service technician actually needs to work less of a day for the employer by starting off at his home.
Well, he doesn't get paid for starting off at his home. In any case,
right, but
whether he's driving a van or he's driving his own car, he doesn't get paid for starting off at home. What I realized is what counsel was saying is that the employer benefits. So if you look back at the rules under Dunlap, you look at the employer benefits. It's a principal activity of the employer when he gets a benefit. And he's saying, well, the principal activity for the employer is repairing vehicles or big trucks or whatever they're doing, cranes or something, big equipment these guys are repairing, and they do it on site. So they may move around during the day, but we're only concerned about from home to when work begins. And if you look at from home to when work begins, without paying the employee to go to work with the van, it's a different amount of work that the employee can get done than if the employee picks up the van and has to drive to a work site. So just for fun, we'll say Beloit's a work site. I don't know where this man lives, but let's just say he lives in Janesville. So if he drives from Janesville to Beloit, he doesn't get paid, and the employer gets to have him working immediately. However, if he goes to Madison and picks up the vehicle, he still has to drive to Beloit, and he gets paid for that drive, but the employer gets no benefit of his doing compensable work during that time. And I think that's the benefit that he was identifying for the employer that I didn't fully understand from the brief. So if you could tell me why I should not be concerned about that, that would help.
A few reasons. First of all, the days are different. They're all different. And it may be that that because there's less work that's getting done, that the actual amount, the work day is shorter, and so that the company actually makes less money on that day by virtue of having the van at home. I think the reason the company has done this is because, taken all together, this is a win-win proposition. Just like Judge Easterbrook said, this is a win-win proposition. The company wouldn't do it if it didn't think this was in its best interest, and the 86 out of 86 employees would not have said, yes, sign me up for this deal, if it weren't a benefit for them as well. But I think this misses the point. The point here in commuting time cannot be the quantum of benefit, how many coffee spoons of benefit to the employer, how many coffee spoons of benefit to the employee. That's not a workable test. If I put one briefcase in my car,
Yeah, well, let's not take those far examples. Let's just look at guys, because we're going to look at these kind of issues on a case-by-case basis. So we're not looking at a briefcase. We're looking at a guy that's got to fix a big tractor out someplace in Wisconsin.
Right. And in the Hormel case, what this court did is to look at those things. How much benefit was being taken by the employer versus the employee? But in the Hormel case, these were captive employees. They had no choice in the matter. In the Hormel case, we have food processing workers.
I know.
They
had
to put on their whites,
and
they didn't have a choice about where, and they didn't have a choice about when.
Right.
That's the opposite of this case.
Yeah.
But that still misses the point that we have a regulation that applies in this case, which is 2G2, that you did not have in the Hormel case.
Right. And if this were to be the rule, then wouldn't we have to conclude that, say, a consulting business that sends its employees off-site to consult with clients, we'd have the same issue there, right? So if you have to drive from home to the company's home office and thence to the clients, and the clock starts when you get to the company, Well, the company's not getting as much billable time to the client, right? Because they can't start billing until the consultant reaches the client. But if the consultant goes directly from home to the client, then the company is getting a larger quantum of work for the same amount of pay. So this is going to be, this would be true whether you're carrying tools or not. Right? It's just a question.
It absolutely would, and it would affect many sectors. It would affect the construction industry. I think court reporters would have a case that when they bring their stuff with them, I think you'd have lots of employees saying, everything I do is for the benefit of the employer. The last point I would leave you with is that the plaintiffs still have not cited one case that has decided the issue of commuting, ordinary commuting, based on this predominantly for the benefit of the employer test. That is not, there's never been an employee who has recovered under a commuting case based on that test. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you. Very interesting. I did a lot of employment law when I was in private practice, so I find these cases very, very interesting. Thank you for a fine argument. Thanks also for coming over to Monroe County. I don't know if that was convenient or inconvenient, but you all are very good to help the court do court with class and come over here. And the briefs were excellent, and so were the oral arguments. So thank you very much. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at about 3 o'clock. Thank you.